So let me introduce Professor James Marone. He is the professor and chair of political science at Brown University. Professor Marone's most recent book is The Heart of Power, Health, and Politics in the Oval Office. I don't actually have a copy to hold up. Is it out yet?
Not out yet.
It's not out yet. That's what I thought. So whew, I'm off the hook. Otherwise, I would have promoted it. His talk today, I think, will be drawing from that work. I haven't seen this book yet, as I said, but if his previous works are any indication, you should run out and buy it. His book, Hellfire Nation, The Politics of Sin in American History, was named Book of the Month by the History News Network and was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. Another book, Democratic Wish, Popular Participation and the Limits of American Government, won the American Political Science Association's Gladys Cramer Award for the best book in the United States, and on the United States, I should say. It probably is the best book in the United States, but and was named a notable book of 1991 by the New York Times. These accolades and awards most certainly reflect Jim's ability to show us a completely new way of thinking about big, important questions like morality politics in the U.S. and our yearnings for democratic participation. But I think they also reflect Jim's writing style. For those who have not had a chance to read his books, you're missing not just important arguments, but the pure pleasure of reading. Jim is an all-too-rare academic who actively writes for a broad audience. He gets rid of the academic jargon so that we are not just, us academics, I mean, are not just talking to each other. He reminds us of the importance of engagement across all walks of life. Now I will shut up so you can see what I mean. It is my great pleasure to welcome Professor Jim Marone.
Introduction. And it's really, I did my graduate work here. It's just so great to be back at the University of Chicago. I taught my very first class in summer school in this building. In my last year at Chicago, I was struggling to finish my PhD, or the last year of my PhD program. I ran out of funding, and Ron Anderson actually put me in charge of the Center for Health Administration Studies workshop. The easiest job I ever had, because he had already invited all the speakers. So I just got paid, and I want to start by saying I'm glad to be back and thanking Ron for saving my hide that last year of grad school, and also not making me do any work. I've always tried to have another job like that, and I've never managed. I actually want to talk on a slightly different topic. I want to talk on the dirty, rotten secrets of health reform. We got into this in the last session. And so I've just finished this book with David Blumenthal, which takes a chapter for each president and looks at how each president, and they all did, grappled with changing the healthcare system, from Franklin Roosevelt to W. Lots of surprises in there, but I thought rather than boring you with historical recitations of largely dead white men, I would tell you what lessons can be drawn from those 70 years of health reform. So here it is, Dirty Rotten Secrets. I've got 8 of them, but I think I'd better back up to get a running start. So we really covered this in the morning session, but let me just take a minute, or 3 minutes, and remind ourselves what the problems with the healthcare system is. So this is the review before we get to the new stuff. Okay, 3 great problems. First, one that came up several times from people in the audience, costs, right? A health expert is someone with lots of synonyms for going up, skyrocketing, exploding, rising, etc. And it's not just the costs go up, that every year they take a little bit more of the entire U.S. economy. Uwe Reinhardt, the hilarious economist from Princeton, sends out these Christmas cards in which he predicts when we'll have it all, 100% of the economy, for healthcare. And he's got a date, he does the models, and he says, well, at this rate it'll be, and every year it gets a little closer, you know, it's just we get closer to it. In fact, as long as I'm talking about this, I remember when I was here, Odin Anderson, a great old sociologist with a shock of white hair, he gave a talk when I was a grad student, and he said, if we don't do something about healthcare costs, by the year 1990, they're going to reach 10% of GDP. They're 16% plus now. And I remember several people in the room just thinking, oh, there's no way. It'll ruin the whole economy. There's no way we'll let that happen. We'll do something before that, mark my words. So, first problem, cost, going up. There's a variation on this, though, that's worth noting. If I had PowerPoint, I'd do it this way. Slide one, U.S. and Canada, World War II to 1971. Two lines, one blue, one red, indistinguishable. They cross five times. For the percentage of the economy going to health care. 1971, Canada gets their Medicare, bam. We keep going north, so to speak. They flatten out. They rise a little bit, but 5% difference in GDP. Every year, a larger gap. That slide, those two slides I just described, kind of hit the American consciousness in the late 70s. And now the way to put it is this. Take the first 6 years of the Bush administration. Across the industrialized world, that is, across OECD nations, the rate of increase of healthcare as percentage of GDP was, on average, zero. Across the OECD, for those 6 years, flat. Now, there are a few exceptions. Britain, Blair was in trouble because of his thing in Iraq, so he tried to flood his system with money. They went up 0.7 of 1% as percentage of GDP. And for the English, this was like being drunken sailors. Tom, you were working in the, where are you, in the English healthcare system, and you know it's still a very tight system. In the period when they went up less than 1% spending like drunken sailors, and the OECD was goose egg, we went up 2.1% of GDP. The extra 2 cents out of every dollar we spent went to healthcare in 6 years. So there is this dual crisis. One, our system is unstable. We can't sustain this forever. We're not going to get to Uwe Reinhardt's Christmas card. We're not going to get to 100%. Sometime it's going to stop. How? That's the question. And secondly, other countries, I'm not saying there's a nirvana out there. If we could just be Austria, we'd solve all our problems. Other countries have managed to grapple with the cost issue. So there's lots of models, but they've all done it. They don't feel like they do it. They all complain like mad. But if you look at the numbers, their numbers are better than ours. So that's our first problem. Problem number two is one several of you brought up, and we all know, the lack of insurance, those great gaps in healthcare insurance. What is it, 47 million people a year now? And we have that Robert Wood Johnson-funded study by the Institute of Medicine that suggested that, and it's the IOM, so it's a pretty good study, that suggests that 18,000 people a year die as a result, 18,000 additional deaths a year as a result of lack of health insurance. Or to put it differently, north of 250,000 deaths, at least according to the IOM, since the Clinton reform flopped. It's a lot. So there's a kind of imperative to do something about this. And it's not just the gaps in health insurance, people who have none, it's people who have an inadequate health insurance. My favorite story illustrating this is a story from Judy Lave, the economist from then at the University of Pittsburgh. She was going to go off to Europe. And being an economist, she didn't trust those healthcare systems in Europe. So she decided she'd better buy private insurance for her family. She writes away, buys private insurance, the policy comes back, and the family is covered except for her son's right leg. She has an 8-year-old son, and his right leg isn't covered. Being an economist, she decided to investigate. She discovered that when he was 3, he fell. They took him to the hospital at the University of Pittsburgh, and they took pictures of his leg. The insurance company got a hold of that incident, decided that was a pre-existing condition, so anything that happened in Europe, fine, except for the right leg. Well, I don't care about Judy Lave's son's right leg, of course, but it does suggest there's a problem in our healthcare system, and not just for the uninsured. The problem is systematic, and we can describe it this way. We tell our insurers, compete. Compete for good product, low price, may the best product for the lowest price win. But the insurers aren't stupid. They're in the business of making money because of the system we have. And what they hear you say is, oh, win. How do we win? Well, don't insure sick people, stupid. We know who they are. They're the chronically ill, they're the poor, they're the old, and they're people who are not affiliated with large groups. The insurers are incredibly, they got great data. They call it risk management. They're really good at it. They can tell who's going to be sick, and they can tell how to win. Don't insure those sick people. So we have a system that systematically shoves aside the sick. Not a great way to insure your population. So here's two American anomalies. Costs out of control, and we don't cover everyone. In fact, we've got a systematic bias for not giving sick people health insurance. No, we have a systematic bias for not giving people who are statistically probably going to be sick health insurance. Finally, something that only came up once in this morning session, I think, but it's worth just spending a minute on. We have terrible outcomes data. I think you mentioned this. Terrible data. Life expectancy at birth. U.S. males, it depends on the number, and Luann and others will tell me the numbers are fuzzy here, and I acknowledge that. But U.S. males are 31st in life expectancy at birth. Women are doing a little bit better, 29th. We're way behind Singapore and Costa Rica, neck and neck with the Sultancy of Brunei. Among rich nations, we are last or almost last in every way you measure population health. The CIA did a study 2 summers ago in which they took the 34 richest countries in the world, and they just had lots and lots of measures. And we whipped Latvia's ass. We kicked butt versus Latvia. We beat them on almost everything, but no one else. So we came in like 33rd, 32nd, 34th. Put it this way. Right now in this second, there's a Japanese boy being born. He is going to live, on average, 3.5 years longer than an American boy being born right now. And the Japanese kid's going to smoke. So if our Olympic team beat only Latvia and came in 34th, there would be serious congressional hearings, Republicans and Democrats together. Now, I know you're saying, but population health doesn't only reflect the healthcare system, and that's true, and we can argue about that. Or you can say the data's fuzzy, and that's true, and we can argue about it. But the outputs of the healthcare system measured against other countries, no, the health data measured against other countries, which is what the healthcare system is supposed to be doing, we just don't look very good. And there's one last thing to add to this, that our inequality on these measures is stunning. There's an old report that people commuting to Washington from some Virginia suburbs pass through counties where the differences in life expectancy literally are the differences between a modern industrial country like Japan and a poor African nation. So it's not just healthcare, of course. It's a whole set of inequalities. So 3 great problems. You can think of others, but let's just remember 3 great problems. Costs, access, and not just the 47 million people uninsured, and not just all those unnecessary deaths, but all the gaps in the system, which I want to memorialize with Judy Lave's son's right leg. And 3rd, in the end of the day, terrible results. Well, if you're a liberal, you cling to Churchill. There's always a Churchill quote for everything, you know. Count on the Americans to do the right thing after they've exhausted every other possibility. Maybe we're there. Maybe we're getting close to the right thing, eh? But as soon as we start talking about healthcare, we come up against the usual barrier, politics, which is what I'm going to talk about, what I am talking about today. When Truman first floated national health insurance, a very interesting story. They couldn't put it through the Senate Finance Committee, which where it should have gone, because the head of the Senate Finance Committee refused to have hearings. So they put it through the Education Committee run by Senator James Murray of Montana. Murray began hearings, and he said, President Truman has introduced health insurance, and out of respect for the president, I'd like us not to use the word socialized medicine. He's gotten 2 minutes into his talk when Senator Robert Taft of Ohio, the Republican leader and a very conservative man, not a very socially graceful man, got up and said, well, I consider it socialism. I consider it the most socialistic bill this body has ever had before it. And Murray, who's also not very graceful, tells him to, quote, shut up. Taft needles Murray, and at the end, Murray goes off the record and starts to shout at Taft, if you don't subside, I'm going to have the officers kick you out. You are so conceited. You are a rotten individual. Of course, Time magazine was there, and you could read the whole thing in Time magazine. So having the official record quiet, it didn't do any good. Taft then gets up and says, I'll have nothing more to do with socialism. And out he goes. And that's the end, effectively, of Truman's national health insurance. One day is how long it lasted. It never had much of a chance, but the Republicans were just, this is socialism. And over again, the word got sent down. Socialism, socialism, socialism. I'm going to give you my favorite quote along these lines. Anybody, people like Colleen have heard this 1,000 times. Jim Brassfield there, and I apologize to them, but it's such a delicious quote, I have to give it to you. It's from, we fast forward from 1946 and 49 to the two times Truman tried, to 1963, when it looks like Medicare is actually going to go through. Whittling down national health insurance, now it's just a program of hospital costs for people over 65 in 1963. The American Medical Association, back when they were the bad guys, cut a recording and sent it to every physician's spouse. Many of you have heard this, I know, but I want you to just listen to the record, the rhetoric in this recording. Write those letters. The physician's spouses, they were expected to be women, were asked to invite their friends in, have coffee, have cookies, and then make the friends, in the frenzy after listening to the recording, write letters to Congress opposing this legislation. Listen to the rhetoric. Write those letters now. Call your friends. Tell them to write. If you don't, I promise you, this program will pass just as surely as the sun will come up tomorrow. And behind it will come other federal programs that will invade every area of freedom as we have known it in this country, till one day we will awake to find that we have socialism. And if you don't do this, and if I don't do this, one of these days we will spend our sunset years telling our children what it was like in America when men were free. Medicare. Now, the guy that got to cut the record was an actor named one Ronald Reagan, who later had a career in politics. And if this all sounds vaguely familiar, the now governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin, quoted the last half of that in her debate with Joe Biden. She skipped the part about this being a speech against Medicare and just talked about what it was like in America when men were free. So the old quote lives on. So there is this strong ideological argument's too weak, obsession, about government, about socialism, about healthcare politics. Now, I know some of my conservative friends, this is SSA, so they may not be here, but my conservative friends would say the old man was right. Or my more skeptical friends would say, yeah, but who had the largest expansion of Medicare when he took office? Well, yes, Ronald Reagan, a short-lived catastrophic health benefit. So Medicare passes, and as president, Reagan overrides all the people in his cabinet but one and passes an extension. And who's the second largest extension? And largest, once Reagan's gets repealed, George W. Bush. So something weird goes on with health care. It's not that it never wins. It's just hard to win. So finally, I get to my main subject, the dirty, rotten secrets of health reform. There's only two that are dirty and rotten, really, but you'll see why in a minute. I've got seven lessons from the past. Oh, I've got an eighth. Eight lessons from the past. I just thought of another one. Eight lessons from the past that were kind of run across the book we've just, and the history lesson we've just done, We went to all the presidential archives, which are just fascinating places, which really reflect the presidents. You go to Harry Truman's, and there's a flame there, sort of an eternal flame, and you think of it as a flame of liberalism, and the staff could not be more helpful. You want to write about national health insurance and that, just bringing you stuff. No one's ever seen this letter. So you go to the Reagan Library, and they say, what are you doing here? Another story. Lesson number one, and this one's only dirty and rotten to political scientists because they don't like it. It takes leadership. It takes extraordinary skill. That's hard to quantify. It's hard to measure. It's hard to make systematic statements about. So political scientists prefer that all presidents are the same, but it takes extraordinary skill to pass a big change through the American system. Now, caveat an important point. Crisis helps a lot. Example. On a Saturday, Franklin Roosevelt is inaugurated. On Sunday, he calls Congress into special session. On Monday, he closes all the banks in the country. 4,000 have failed already. 4,000 banks down. He closes them all. Does he have the power to do that? There's a law, the Trading with the Enemies Act, that was passed for World War I. Does this give him power? The Germans defeated now, right? It's 1933. Does he have the power to close all the banks? Probably not. Crisis. 4,000 banks are down. No one's going to sue him for closing all the banks. So he takes authority he doesn't really have, maybe, and closes all the banks. On Wednesday, he has a press conference, and he starts to he seduces the press. Everybody's very tense, but by the end, the transcript shows laughter, laughter, laughter. He says these are going to be nice, friendly, warm sessions. They've never had press conferences like that before. Thursday, he sends Congress a bill to put the Federal Reserve Board behind the banking system. And he says, I'd like it passed today. 8 hours later, it's back on his desk. Incredible. 8 hours. The whole banking system of America changed. On Thursday, he signs the bill. On Saturday, he goes on his first fireside chat. First one about the banking system. 1 week into office. And he says, in that plummy voice of his, he says, okay, the banks are going to start opening on Monday. They're safe. You got the whole Federal Reserve. Don't worry what the Federal Reserve is. It's behind the banks. And then he says, it would be unfashionable, this very fashionable wealthy man, it would be unfashionable to hoard. The rest of the month, $750 million goes back into the banks. That's leadership, but that's crisis. He couldn't have gotten away with it in the 1920s. He used the media, he browbeat Congress, he overstepped his authority, he had a lot of luck, and he saved the banking system. This extraordinary man had three great opportunities to do something about health care, 1935, 1938, and 1943, when his staff was begging him, not in 35, but in 38 and 43, he never touched it, never touched it, always ducked. So it's not only leadership in crisis, it's also the desire to fight a heck of a battle, which Roosevelt would not expend his limited political capital. He knew what he had a limited amount. He wasn't going to spend it on health care. Part B, no crisis, or no big crisis, leadership. And here the story is running the most complicated government machinery in the world. Congress is amazing. We take it for granted. Clinton sends his bill over. Four different congressional committees mark it up. By the end of that process, there are four separate bills. How those four separate bills might have become a law is quite a story. But if you want to look at skill, we have a marvelous example, and that's Lyndon Johnson. He was extraordinary. He knew how to run that machine. The usual story of the passage of Medicare goes like this. John F. Kennedy pushed Medicare. There was a civil rights crisis, as was said this morning. And then with the assassination of Kennedy, the great landslide occurs. Johnson sweeps into office, but so do a lot of Democrats. We have a huge Democratic majority, and Medicare becomes inevitable. Wilbur Mills, who had single-handedly defeated Medicare year in and year out, even when there was a majority in Congress for it, now switches. When Medicare is inevitable, the original Medicare bill submitted by the Johnson administration had only hospitals in it. There were two other bills, what is now Medicare Part B, doctor's fees, and what is now Medicaid, one from the AMA, one from the Republicans. After the hearings and at the end of the markup sessions, Wilbur Mills, the great opponent of Medicare, turns to Wilbur Cohen, the draftsman, and says, Wilbur, but he doesn't turn to him. He looks at the two people suggesting the other bills and says, I like your bills. Let's pass them all. Medicare Part A, Medicare Part B, Medicaid. Let's pass them all. Wilbur, he turns to Wilbur Cohen. He says, can you draft that legislation by tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.? Cohen says, can I have till 5? And no, 9 a.m. Cohen runs back to the White House. This is in Johnson's memoirs, The Vantage Points. And he says, Wilbur Mills, he wants to triple the size of Medicare. What do I do? It's going to triple the cost. What do I do? And Johnson says, I think we'll go call my brother. And Wilbur asks, what? And Johnson says, you don't know that story? Every Texan knows that story. Well, turns out they're giving a Texas boy a test to be a trainman. And they put him next to the train switch, and they say, train coming north in 50 miles an hour, and a train going south. Train going south 50 miles an hour, train going north 50 miles an hour. What do you do? There's the switch. And the kid says, I think go call my brother. It's not the right answer. Why are you going to do that? Well, he ain't never seen no train wreck before. Let Wilbur do it. That's the green light. Wilbur Cohen goes back, writes the legislation, goes to Wilbur Mills, says, yeah, you can have, Johnson says you can have $500 million. And Johnson tells the story in the Vantage Point. Cohen tells the story over and over again. And Johnson concludes it by saying the villain of the case for so many years, Wilbur Mills, became the hero of the old folks. Except it didn't happen that way. As soon as Johnson takes office, he had a taping system so we know what he was saying in the White House. He calls Wilbur Mills again and again. And he says, Wilbur, I want Medicare. And Wilbur says, how can I do this with a straight face? I've been opposing it all these years. Johnson says, say it's not big enough. Say the bill you opposed wasn't good enough. Say the Mills bill, he always called it the Mills bill, we'll have more. And they hatched all three parts. Johnson suggests Medicaid. Johnson suggests Part B. But he always pretends that Wilbur suggested it. He says, I'm not getting into the details. You do it. I just want to make you happy. Wilbur, this could make you vice president. Wilbur likes the sound of that. Wilbur, I got the money. I'm willing to spend it. Wilbur, you'll get all the credit. And so Wilbur, he literally... At one point, Wilbur Mills is walking onto the House floor, and Johnson is talking to one of his lieutenants who manages, and he says, who's walking there? Oh, Wilbur Mills, put him on. Hey, Wilbur, how's the Mills bill coming? There was no surprise at all. But it's only now that the archives have released these tape recordings that we know Johnson was in on the secret. He absolutely passed the credit, and for 50 years, we haven't known that he was in on it. Again and again, Johnson is in there getting this bill through Congress. Second example. They finally win at Ways and Means, which means it's pretty much inevitable. We've got a tape recording. The House leaders, starting with Wilbur Mills, call Johnson, and they're very excited. We got it through. We passed. Johnson doesn't even say, good work, boys. He says, all right. The next problem is the Rules Committee has to give you the rule, which means the green light to put it on the floor. And he starts berating them that they might try to bottle it up and give the AMA a chance to recoup. Here's what it sounds like. Now, you remember this. 9 out of 10 things I get into trouble on is because the bills, lay around. It stinks. It's just like a dead cat on the floor. For God's sake, don't let dead cats sit on your porch. He's screaming. Mr. Rayburn used to say, and now he's pounding his desk, they stink and they stink and they stink and they stink. When you get one of those bills out of your committee, you get that son of a bitch called up before they can get their letters written. Hey, yes, sir. Yes, sir. 2 days later, it's on the House floor. He just saw what the problems were before they happened. There's story after story like this as Medicare negotiates. Johnson perpetuated the myth. It was inevitable. It was a landslide. Wilbur Mills did it. No. I could tell you a couple others, but you could just read the book. Well, I'll tell you one more. So right before all this is happening, before the landslide, the opponents of Medicare have a great trick. It's an election year, right? It's October 64. They suggest increasing Social Security a lot right before the election. Ooh, sounds good. But that would increase the Social Security taxes enough to cut off any chance of Medicare after the election. And it looks like they have enough votes in the Reconciliation Committee. It looks like it's going to happen. And then two strong opponents of Medicare vote against Social Security and therefore leave room in the tax thing. One of them, Smathers of Florida, George Smathers of Florida, they ask him, why'd you do that? And he says simply, well, Lyndon told me to. Long does it too, and a year later we have a tape of him in the office, Oval Office, and he calls Lyndon and he says, Lyndon, they're closing a base. They're closing a base in my state. It's a big base. You got to save me. And Lyndon says, if McNamara's closing it, I can't do anything. I can't move McNamara. And Long says, Lyndon, when you needed that vote on Medicare, I didn't go back on you. An hour later, there's a phone call back. Oh, your base isn't on the list. No, no, no. You must have got that wrong. It's not on the list. No, no, no. Johnson was wheeling and dealing and getting it through. Take-home point, big change in the United States and the American system is really hard. Lee Hamilton likes to say, healthcare is a non-incremental issue and Congress is an incremental body. To get it through, to win, you've got to have extraordinary skill. A president who doesn't know what he or she someday is doing need not apply. You want complexity? Look what's happening right now. You political scientists in the room, you know this already. But what's going on with healthcare? Budget reconciliation. The House and the Senate have both passed a bill. Now it's in reconciliation, right? A budget bill. The House bill says health care will be treated like a normal budget item. What's that mean? That means no filibusters and it only takes 50 votes in the Senate. The budget resolution may not be filibustered. That's the House bill. The Senate bill says it's in the budget, the $714 billion, but it won't be treated like a normal budget, a piece of the budget. What does that mean? It takes 60 votes. The House passed it one way, the Senate passed another way. Now there's a small group of men and women who are about to meet in reconciliation. What they decide will probably predict, will predict what kind of health reform we get, and may very well decide whether we get it at all. How many people know that? Here's an opportunity to vote against it before you vote for it, to coin a phrase. John Kerry said that. It was not a funny joke. Okay. So notice what I'm saying. Sometime in a tiny little note in the bottom of the New York Times, it's going to say, I don't think the Chicago Tribune is even going to get to it because it's too far away from Chicago. It's going to say who won this debate in budget reconciliation. And that's going to have a lot to do. 50 votes, Harry Reid can get 50 votes. 60 votes, not so sure. It is an extraordinarily complex system. It takes great skill. All right, that's my first dirty, rotten lesson of health reform. I'll go through the others a little more slowly. I get carried away with that one. Number two. This one Rosemary Stevens talked about. I call it band of kooks. It takes a band of kooks. And this is what I mean. Most great changes in American history take a small group of crazy believers. They believe. And everybody says, you can't get that. Single payer? No. Never going to happen. And the band of kooks push, and they push, and they push, and all of a sudden people start coming on. They never compromise. They just keep pushing. People call them kooks. Abolition. The abolition of slavery. When William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass started on that in 1830, people thought they were nuts. Milton Friedman. When I was in school around here in the mid-70s, he had this, markets will solve everything. He was a kook. And then all of a sudden, 10 years later, I go off to Brown and Brees, Milton Friedman this, Milton Friedman that. I thought, that kook! But he stuck to his guns and conquered much of the world. Gingrich. This guy Newt Gingrich comes to Congress in 88 and says, the Republicans can take over. And we're all like, we're political scientists, get out of here. There's no way God made the Congress Democratic. What, are you nuts? It takes someone who believes to push and push and push. Medicare was like that. Medicare first comes up in 1953 when they decide to back off national health insurance. And a handful of individuals just believe and fight and push. And then the moment suddenly comes. All of a sudden, it gathers momentum. Lyndon Johnson used to listen to the tapes from the 1960 campaign trail. And he'd say, they're all clapping loudest for Medicare. And he'd go to Kennedy. And he'd say, they're all clapping. A few people pushed and pushed and pushed through the dark 50s, and by the early 60s, it was on everybody's lips. So it takes a group of true believers who push and push and push and suddenly have their opportunity. Skill, kooks, number three. This you all know. In fact, it came up several times this morning. Beatrix mentioned it. It takes a movement. The band of kooks have to get people going. Congress is a nervous institution. It doesn't do things in a vacuum, not big things. Jill Quadagno, a terrific sociologist, interviewed members of Congress about the Carter Hospital Containment Bill. And the usual story is, the industry killed it. It actually snuck through the Senate, but the industry killed it in the House. She went and interviewed a couple of House members, and Bill Gratison, who is one of the leaders of the Republicans on health care, said, it died because I did not get a single letter on it. If they don't get a single letter on it, it's not going to happen. Letters, emails, phone calls, IMs, tweets, it's got to happen, and it's got to happen in huge volume, and that means it's got to have a movement behind it. That's the point of the band of kooks, is getting the movement going. Sometimes you can hitch on to a movement. Social Security, there was Huey Long going around the country saying any income over $1 million, 100% tax. For that matter, any estate over $5 million, 100% tax. Take it all, redistribute it. Social Security was incredibly mild. Conservatives in Congress still thought it was socialism, but compared to Huey Long, hey, and that was a movement. So that was easy. So if you can't find your own movement, hitch a ride on someone else's. But it takes a movement. Lesson number four, speed. Speed. This is a piece of political wisdom that's rarely acknowledged, although I think Barack's got it. Right after the great landslide, LBJ gathered his staff around him, and he said, I've just won the biggest landslide a Democrat's won since 1936. It was, in fact, the second biggest landslide a Democrat had ever won. And second or third, I forget about 1932, but close to. And he says, you got to move fast. Every day I lose some power. Every day someone kicks me. You got to get me as many bills through as you can get. Don't settle on one a day. If you can get two, get two. He understood that a president's power diminishes every day. Now, sometimes you get a second wind. 9/11 gave George Bush a second wind. But that's unusual. The Paul Starr, the sociologist who worked on the Clinton health reform, he wrote, we thought it was a change in the climate for health reform, but it wasn't. It was a change in the weather. It's always just the change in the weather. The window of opportunity closes fast. And here's the key. What's the nearest election? Right now, we're still kind of glazed by the Obama election. My God, he won North Carolina. Can you believe it? He won North Carolina, won Virginia, won North Carolina. Oh, he almost competitive in Georgia. We're still talking about that. 6 months from now, it will be ancient history. We'll all be talking about the next election. That changes the dynamics in Congress entirely. The savvy health advisor, in sum, tells her president-elect, tells her boss, the day after the election, hurry up, Mr. or Ms. President-elect, you're almost out of time. Lesson five, beware the seduction of technique. Political debates are about big, huge changes when it comes to healthcare. Socialism. The Democrats were always looking for an answer to the socialism thing. Kennedy, or actually Sorensen, came up with it for Kennedy. By 1962, 63, when it's back in raging debate, Sorensen figured out that the AMA had opposed Social Security. He had Kennedy all loaded up in the notes for one of his press conferences. And when socialism came up, Kennedy said, oh yeah, you know, they said the same thing about Social Security. If they oppose Social Security, they oppose Medicare, same thing. The AMA, every press conference, he went in with that in his notes. Socialism for Medicare is socialism for Social Security. Finally, the AMA writes him a letter. We saw this in the files. They said, we didn't oppose it before it was passed. And Kennedy writes back and says, oh, you only opposed it after it was passed. I'll clarify that in my next press conference. Symbols. The opposite of great symbols is finding a technical solution. This is known as Ira Magaziner. I've got an algorithm that'll solve your problem. No, your problem is political, not some new technique. Everybody knows this. One of my favorite stories about this is during the Reagan administration, Doc Bowen, the head of Health and Human Services, Reagan called him Doc. Doc Bowen, he was a savvy political operator, one of the few in the Reagan cabinet, and he wanted catastrophic health care. Well, the conservatives in the cabinet did not. And so one of them, the head of the Council of Economic Advisors, came up with a voucher plan that wasn't very well thought out. And Doc Bowen took a piece of paper and said, now let me follow the money here. So the government is paying the old person line. The old person is paying the insurance company line. The insurance company is paying the doc. And he covers the paper with lines. So this line and this line. This is how your system is going to work. And Ronald Reagan is laughing at all this. The voucher system was too complicated. He caricatured it. Ira Magaziner was easily caricatured. Remember, this is about symbols, not techniques. Democrats tend to answer great symbolic gusts with, we've got a better algorithm, doesn't work. Which leads me to an aside. I'm almost done. It leads me to an aside. For the last generation, the idea of social insurance has been hiding in the closet, at least in Washington. The idea that we're all in this together, that we're one insurance pool, the idea of the social gospel, the idea so beautifully put and so irresistible when Martin Luther King was running around the country giving the speeches, I am inevitably my brother's keeper because I'm my brother's brother. If that's the soundtrack to your times, then the idea that we're all in this together makes sense. Since about, January 22nd, 1981, that soundtrack, Ronald Reagan's inauguration, that soundtrack has diminished, and then finally shut out. What I want to suggest is that for those of you who believe in social insurance, the time is ripe to come out of the closet and make yourselves heard. Come on out, and in the great battle over symbols, lots of Democrats will say, oh, yeah, let's compromise. Yeah, let's have a better system, process, algorithm. You also need a better philosophy, and I'd say it's time to bring back the social gospel. So there is no beware the seduction of technique. And very related to it, lesson six. I've only got eight. Lesson six. The president should not be bogged down in details. The president is about going public. This is one of the great stories of presidential history. Harry Truman throws his health insurance on the table and does nothing. Michael Davis writes him letter after letter. Mr. President, you've got to go out there and meet the AMA face to face. Truman, the first time around, didn't trust his own speaking voice. Here he was after the great titan, the Franklin Roosevelt. What was Harry Truman? Nothing. And then he found his voice on that extraordinary 1948 campaign. He learned how to speak in public. His staff just gave him little phrases, no sentences, no speeches written, and he'd hammer these little phrases, and he was good at it, and he learned that he was good at it. When national health insurance comes up again in 1949, this was one of the great themes of his campaign, people beg him, get back on the train. And he keeps telling the press, get ready to pack your trunks, we're going on the train again for national health insurance. But for some reason we've never been able to fathom, he never did, he never goes public. JFK went public. His first press conference gets a television audience of 64 million people. And on that day, in his first week in office, the presidency changed. They were stunned. They didn't realize his opinion ratings went up to 70%. This is a guy who won the election by that much. 70% and stayed there for a year until he started messing around with civil rights. And they suddenly realized the president has to go public. The big picture, the narrative, that's the president's job. Democrats blow this every time. Jimmy Carter, memo after memo, we see in his nice hand. In one memo, I swear to you, he writes, we need more PSROs. PSROs are physician review organizations, and some people in this room actually know what they are. They review hospital costs. But the president should not know what a PSRO is and should not be spending their time writing, we need more PSROs. Clinton and the most amazing mousetrap, no. If you're the president, leave the PSROs to the experts. Okay, skill. Kooks, movement, speed, beware the seduction of technique, philosophy, not details. Seven, and here's one my co-author really wants me to shut up about. Ever since he's become an important person in the Obama administration, this one makes him nervous, although I do have the green light to talk about it. He just gets a little worried. Tell the economists to shut up. Every single health reform, every single one, there are no exceptions, back to Truman. The exception is the Roosevelt administration, Morgenthau, but since Truman, the economists come in and say, oh, Mr. President, you can't do it, it'll wreck the economy. If you want health reform, you need a president strong enough to say, I've heard you, thank you, shut up. Ike wants 80 million in health spending, and the Bureau of the Budget goes nuts. And so he cuts it down to 20 million, and he writes an apologetic. JFK, they tell him, okay, here's what Medicare is going to cost. The next week, JFK gives a speech. It costs half. Where did the other half go? He just told the Bureau of the Budget. I got my own estimate. LBJ was best at this. So he says, I don't tell Lady Bird that she can't have coffee and she can't have sugar. You gotta have coffee and sugar. I don't tell you that you can't have health care and you can't have education. It's like coffee and sugar. I don't care how much it costs. You gotta have it. This is the Hubert Humphrey. And then there's a senator from Massachusetts elected in 1962, one Ted Kennedy. We got him on the phone, and Kennedy wants to know how to do a bill. This is the greatest one of the three or four greatest legislators in history. He wants to know how to do a bill. And Johnson is saying, the most important thing, don't let the budget people get a hold of it. They'll kill you. They'll kill you. He said, they want to estimate Medicare 5 years out. They're telling them it's going to cost $1 billion. And people say, oh, my God, $1 billion. I'm against it. I'm losing votes all the time. I got to shut those fools up. You shut those fools up, he tells Kennedy. That's pretty cavalier. If you're an economist, you're thinking, well, Medicare costs spiked. It was incredibly expensive. If we had had good cost estimates, I don't believe we'd have ever passed Medicare. Accurate cost estimates, I believe, would have sunk that program. And when it gets to the Senate, the economists finally have gotten to Johnson. It gets to the Senate, and the senators, the liberals, are trying to add things on. How about long-term care? How about catastrophic costs? How about prescription drugs? And the economists are saying, no, it'll put too much drag on the economy. And Johnson squashes exactly the three things we've been fighting to add to Medicare for the last 50 years. Every single health bill has economists coming in and saying, oh boy, you're going to mess up the economy. And you know who was one of the fiercest on this? George W. Bush. He just said, no, I'm spending $400 billion for my prescription drug plan. That's it. I'm doing it. And that was the end of the discussion. He was firm. He was sort of self-confident about telling the economists, you don't scare me. Democrats tend to wither before the economists. One notes when Daschle steps down that the most important people in the administration are the erstwhile president of a school in Cambridge and Timothy Geithner. I hope Barack tells the economists to shut up, and I'm glad my co-author, David Blumenthal, will be in the mix. Lesson number 7, well, let's be a little more polite. Hush the economists. To the economists in the room, I know you're exceptions. It's just the economists in the Oval Office. Last lesson, learn how to lose. It may be the most important lesson, because if you're going to pursue health reform, you're probably going to lose. So learn how to lose. What do I mean? Harry Truman lost. He never got close. He never got it out of committee. But he made this his life campaign. He said over and over again, this is my biggest defeat. This is a defeat for the American people. And so the movement that eventually gathered had Harry Truman as their great symbol, their great emblem. When Johnson actually passes Medicare, what does he do? He flies to Independence, Missouri. So Harry Truman, it's one of the most touching moments in social insurance history. Johnson turns to Truman and says, only you can understand how I feel today. And Truman says, this is the happiest day of my life. This is what I fought for all those years. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. He kept it alive. Contrast Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton loses. Go read his biography. It's very revealing. My life. When Bill Clinton has health insurance, lots of reasons why he lost, and it's a whole other lecture, but I promise I won't give it now. He has a beautiful speech many of you will remember in which he talks about how it's hard, our children will find it hard to believe that families lost everything, lost their home, lost their savings, lost everything because one of their children got sick. Our grandchildren will say, how could our society have been so mean? It was a beautiful speech. Health reform goes down. You can look page after page of his biography for any memory of the poor family that lost everything because their child got sick. It's not there. What does he say? I felt bad for Hillary because she took the rap. That's it. And then he says, I probably should have gone for welfare reform. I could have gotten that. Maybe we wouldn't have lost the house. Nothing. He walked away from it, so the Republicans entirely controlled the spin. If you look at the Republican documents, what they were worried about was national health insurance would be so popular, the Democrats would reestablish their connection to the middle class. But that's not the narrative that came out. The narrative that came out was, oh my God, magaziner, ugh, Clinton, what a fool. Thank God, Bob Dole, you stopped us from that monstrosity. That's the narrative. And Clinton never challenged that. So for 10 years, there was the Democrats' signature issue was off the table, as were most of the Democrats. Skill, kooks, movement, speed, beware the seductions of technique. It's about philosophy, not details. Hush the economists and learn how to lose. Those are it. You do all those 8, you'll get national health insurance. You know, I'm going to give you a parable. So being back here at the University of Chicago, I feel the need for a parable, and I'll end with this parable. It's a parable of building a good community, which, of course, is what social insurance is about. It turns out that back in the late Renaissance, there was a very saintly pope, Pedro Moroni. And Pedro's people came in and told him, Your Eminence, there is a Jewish community right in the middle of Rome. They're heathens. They're barbarians. They're unchristian. You have to make them leave. And the Pope said, well, I can't just make them leave just like that. I have to find out. I'll give them a test. And so he calls the rabbi in. And the Pope gives the rabbi a test. And the test goes like this. And the rabbi very quickly goes, and the Pope says, oh, rabbi, that's a very good answer. You're absolutely right. Pope goes like this, and the rabbi goes like this, and the Pope goes, rabbi, you're absolutely right. And the Pope strides over to the sideboard and takes a piece of bread, pops it in his mouth. And the rabbi takes a grape and pops it in his mouth. The Pope hugs the rabbi and says, rabbi, we have no doctrinal differences. I don't know what my advisors are thinking about. Your people are my people. My people are your people. Don't be a stranger. The rabbi says, come visit us. Don't be a stranger. They hug, and off they go. Well, the Pope's advisors come to him. You can't, the Pope's infallible. You can't challenge what he's decided, but you can question his methodology. And so they do. Well, what was that about, Holy Father? And the Pope says, well, you are completely wrong. Look, I said that I was the spiritual ruler of the entire universe. And he reminded me of humility. He said, only down here, Holy Father. And he was absolutely right. And then I said, there's but one God. And he said, no, there are two gods, God the Father, God the Son. And he forgot the Holy Spirit. But you people can't even explain the Holy Spirit. That's enough partial credit for me. And then we took bread, symbol of the Eucharist. He took grape, symbol of the blood. Gentlemen, let's have no more talk about the Jews, please. Meanwhile, at this very moment, the rabbi comes back, and all these people gather around him. Rabbi, rabbi, what happened? He said, typical negotiations, tough negotiations. He started with his bottom line. He said, you people clear out of here. And I said, we're staying right here. And then he escalated to threats. He said, I poke your eye out. And I upped the ante and said, I poke your both your eyes out. And then we shared a light lunch.
Thank you. Do you want to do questions, or I trust people in the commission? Thank you. Do you want to do questions, or you can also just go back to eating if you prefer.
Yeah, this one, right? Oh.
Okay.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Well, I really look forward to reading your new book.
Okay.
And I loved these 8 dirty secrets. And I imagine that your second edition is going to have a chapter on the Obama administration. So what is that chapter? What are the highlights of that chapter?
So far, he's doing everything right except one thing. A year before, the day after the election, actually too late, he got it. A year before this was... Before he was elected, he had a staff putting together a health reform, and he knew, and he and Daschle knew Daschle was going to run it. It was amazing. I believe he's done everything else right. The Daschle loss is huge. You may think, oh my God, the guy doesn't pay his taxes, Democrats are scum. That's fine, but it is a huge loss. Now, when Clinton suffered a similar loss, which I won't go into now, but he suffered a similar loss. He wanted to put his health reform in budget reconciliation so it couldn't be filibustered and would just sweep right through in March. Had he succeeded in doing that, he might have won. Harry Byrd says, you can't do that. We have to have a debate. And once that was done, it may be he should have completely changed his tactics. Obama completely changed his tactics when Daschle went down. He didn't have anybody else ready to go. And so he changed. He called Ted Kennedy in. Ted Kennedy and what is his, I'm blocking on his name now, the other guy. Baucus, thank you, Max Baucus. And he says, it's yours now, I'll give you technical support, I'll give you backup, and now the Congress people are actually running the reform with technical support from the White House. It is really smart. He knew he did not have time to build another team together, and he couldn't find someone with the heft of a Daschle to make it go through. Ted Kennedy has spent his whole life, he's like, every third page of our book, right? He spent his whole life doing health reform, and he's now making this his last crusade. People in Congress really love him. He is a lovely, I've hung out with these guys a little bit. He's got enormous respect, and he has cashed all his life's chips are on the table now. And his view is, I'm going to do what it takes before I die. And Obama is like, I'm behind you, what do you need? That is just, he just has the rhythm. Now, will he ask for enough? Will he ask for too much? Will it all come together? Will it all fall apart? We'll know in the next few weeks, really. As I say, the first thing to watch is what comes out of the reconciliation between House and Senate budget statements. That'll be huge. If the House statement holds, we're probably going to get something pretty big. If it doesn't hold, we're going to need something that has, depending on what happens in Minnesota, 2 or 3 Republicans. So you can't get further. Specter has a challenge on the right from him. So very difficult to get anything as a result. Specter, the senator from Pennsylvania, who is being challenged in the Republican primary by a conservative named Toomey.
Is the Senate going to get the moderate Democrats, the people like Bi? I mean,
this is where the first dirty rotten secret, it's going to take huge skill. I mean, this is pure. If you think it's just, let me see how many, it's not going to be like that. It will take extraordinary effort. To get to 60 would take miraculous effort. If Lyndon Johnson were president, I would say, yeah, I'd bet on it. If Jimmy Carter were president, I'd say there's no way in heck. We'll see what Barack Obama and his team does. One of the most underestimated jobs in Washington is the congressional liaison. Johnson told his congressional liaison, you can have anybody in the executive branch. You're my most important person. You like someone in the executive branch, I detail him to you. Jimmy Carter's executive liaison, let's just say he was unpopular with Congress. There are stories, but no need to. I don't think they were completely his fault. We'll see. But skill. We like to think it's kind of inevitable. It's the clash of interest groups. It's the parallelogram of force. No. It's the human skill of convincing people this is in their interest or in the country's good or some mix of the two. And that's hard but doable. Yeah. And we had another one over here.
Okay. I was looking for a comment on this. In your review of your work in the 70s in the White House, I can't remember exactly what year it was, but there was one year in which the Department of Education and Department of Health were under one cabinet post, and then they split.
Yes.
And I remember the two mission statements, and I found the evolution of it very interesting, because if you read the mission statement of education, it literally has the word access, and if you look at their policy and how they developed it, the focus of access was, through high school. But if you look at the mission statement for Department of Health and Human Services, it talks about providing the best possible care. And if you look at the policy and what they're doing that. So sometimes I feel like there's market conflict because there is a lot of discussion on access, but it's not in the mission.
I didn't realize that. That would have been a great addition. I wish the book hadn't gone to the printer, because that's a great footnote. It's part of a fantastic story. Jimmy Carter made the Department of Education. Joe Califano was the head of health and health, education, and welfare, and he had been in the Johnson White House and had taken all power away from the cabinet posts. For the Model Cities program, he called up the head of the Department of Labor and said, we've got this new program going down. And the head of the Department of Labor said, oh, this sounds great. Let me research that. And Califano said, no, we're announcing it today. Califano was obsessed with keeping all power away from the White House. They finally fired him. So he was trying to protect his programs and sort of celebrate what Health and Human Services were doing. So the story you've just told really fits the story of this very strong reformer who also absolutely believed in the mission of his cabinet post and fought the White House tooth and nail. That's a very interesting story about the bias of the bureaucracies.
Thank you, Jim. That was such a fantastic talk. I was thinking about your message to the economists to hush, a dangerous proposition to make at the University of Chicago. But
yes, I know that.
And it makes me wonder why, or are there economists who should be listened to at this time? Why aren't we hearing more about the message that you opened your talk with, which is that other countries spend less and cover everybody? Is that an economic message that you think the Obama White House is hearing? Are there people that they should be listening to?
The Obama White House, let me back up. The economist brief is to make sure the economy doesn't go south before the next election. It's not a long-term brief. That's their job. And if you suddenly come and say, we're going to spend a ton of money, today is a little bit different, right, with the stimulus. But even now, their job is to worry about that. If you want to reform the healthcare system and your time horizon is 2 years, you'll get what my grandmother called bigots.
or expansions of Medicaid. That's where it's calling. That's not because you'll get expansions of Medicaid, improvements from Medicare. You can't get more if what you're thinking is what will this do over 2 years. So I don't want to just say it's because the economists are crazy or cruel. It's because their job is to get the guy elected the next time, and they're looking merely at the economic, at what they see. And economists in general, and University of Chicago economists in particular, have certain feelings about deficits and government, and those don't fit with a national health system. But the answer really is that Americans don't pay much attention. I mean, if you come back from abroad and say, oh, there's this great system in, you name your country, it's very easy to drag a doctor from Australia. Mate, that system is terrible. It's not hard to do at all. And so if you actually believe in a single payer, going abroad, that doesn't do you. Look, guys, don't use the term single payer, please. Never. It's Medicare for all. Make people, if you believe in it, make people say, I'm against Medicare. Well, I want to protect it for people over 65. I just don't want my children to have it. That's a different kind of single payer. Sounds like some bureaucrat from the NHS made it up, doesn't it? So, Medicare for all, it sounds good. At least it does to me. I've released my bias, haven't I? But arguing what happened, for policymakers know. We know about international systems. We also know that there's no nirvana. There is no system ready to be taken off the shelf. What's the largest government-run healthcare system in the world? Easy, Medicare or Medicaid, 1 and 2. We pay more. So we have a lot of history with government-run systems. But what happens abroad is not things that move the American public. And it's too easy to twist. The poor Canadians, what a battering they took every time anybody talks about the Canadian healthcare system. People come up with all kinds of things. I remember when I was first talking about single payer, the people say, well, but 80% of the Canadian population lives within 100 miles of the United States. Wow, there's a refutation of the Canadian healthcare system, right? Like, what does that mean? But this is a fact, you know, Canadians. Oops, okay, it's going the other way.
Hi, I'm Greg Van Hefty. I'm a student here at SSA and in the graduate program of healthcare administration and policy as well. I attended one of the Obama healthcare community input sessions back in December, and I'm interested in what your thoughts are about, as this administration goes along, how will that community organizing spirit that Obama's been doing since the beginning of the campaign, will that stay in specifically for the issue of healthcare reform, and how influential do you think the people's voice will be at that table?
If it looks like it's staying, and it looks like Obama is strong, it will be scarier and scarier to oppose his national health insurance or his national health reform. It really gets back to your question, what's going to happen? If he looks wounded, if that falls apart, and he looks wounded a year from now, the Democrats will all start to peel off and try to save their own hides. If he looks powerful, you're a Democrat in Virginia, you're sort of not secure. And if he's running high in Virginia, you're gonna want his coattails. So how Obama looks, how strong he looks, and whether his movement remains around him will have a lot to do with how much credibility he has as he negotiates with individuals. Popularity is a tradable, fungible commodity in Washington. As long as he's popular, people will come and meet him halfway because they'll be afraid not to. As his popularity leaks away, Bill Clinton came to office already unpopular. He won 43% of the vote, and then he blundered into, rather than trying to stride into, gays for the military. Huge debate. Everybody wanted to make distance between him. So that you've asked the million-dollar question, and the answer is, if it's still going strong 6 months from now, Obama will be very powerful. Moderate Democrats will be afraid to oppose him.
Cool.
You also, Jane.
Hi, I'm Laura Brogan with the GAO. Piggybacking off of your statement about, you know, stay away from the term single payer, you know, now a lot of the bills that are out there are for an individual purchase mandate, similar to what they did in Massachusetts. So my question to you is, what do you think the chances are that that will pass? And then if it does, what impact and how much progress will that make in towards the goal of having some form of comprehensive health insurance in this country?
I am not a purist anymore. Back when I was here as a student, nothing but the best would do. Now I'll take anything. But that's my own personal view, and I'm sure this room would split up in a lot of different views. The single payer, the whole Massachusetts experiment, and what happens, all comes down really to this, to the nub of the issue. Excuse me, and it goes like this. When people fall out of the private health insurance system, as people inevitably do, how robust is your public system? That is right where the debate is in Massachusetts. It turns out God had this little fate, and the economy crashed, which means the public system becomes very expensive. Is it a good public system? That's the great Massachusetts question. Where the debate is right now in Washington, the Republicans have started to say, we don't want a public system because that will crowd out the private system. The Democrats have started to say, if the public system is better than the private system, it'll win by competition. Aren't you guys for competition? The Democrats are delighting in competition talk. That's where the crux is. Obama has always said, you don't have to change health care. We're not going to force anything on anybody. We're not even going to have an individual mandate. But if you fall out of the system, there'll be a public system to catch you. It's still a safety net, as someone was saying this morning. The question, the million-dollar question, is how good that public system is. My own advice to Obama was during the campaign, that public system ought to cover every. Someone comes to the hospital, they're not insured. You do the wallet biopsy, they're not insured. Zip, and they go to the public system automatically. They apply for it. Because you've got an individual mandate, everybody's got to be covered. If you're not covered, you're in the public system. That's a pretty liberal view. That view, I think, would have a pretty extensive government system. The Republicans worry that that government system would soon become a universal system. And all I have to do is say to that, go to the airport and watch the guys clustering around the counter trying to get into business class. Americans love business class, and business class will always be the private health insurance system. Give us a good, robust public system. Give us more seat room and leg room in the public system, and you know the insurers will still have lots of business giving everybody business class. But to get to the nub of the answer, the heart of the answer, I think, employer mandates are as good or as not good from the perspective of social justice as the public system that undergirds it. In Massachusetts, they set up a good one, and now the inevitable question, how are we going to fund this thing, now that it's much larger than expected, that will be the federal question, too. Republicans, we don't want a public system. Democrats, oh, public system, let us compete. That'll be the question. Oh, have I talked you into submission?
Is there time for one more?
Last one. Hey, okay, thank you.